With holiday chaos around every corner, the minute you step into your BMW, you're in control. The BMW X3's adventure-ready agility is built for wherever the holidays take you. The effortless power of the X5 makes it easy to take on the season, and the iconic 3 Series is an exhilarating escape. The BMW Roadhome sales event on now. BMW, the ultimate driving machine.
Hurry in for exceptional offers through November 30th.
There's nothing like sinking into luxury. Anabe sofas combine ultimate comfort and design at an affordable price. Anabe has designed the only fully machine washable sofa from top to bottom. The stain-resistant performance fabric slipcovers and cloud-like frame duvet can go straight into your wash. Perfect for anyone with kids, pets, or anyone who loves an easy-to-clean, spotless sofa. With a modular design and changeable slipcovers, you can customize your sofa to fit any space and style. Whether you need a single chair, love seat, or a luxuriously large sectional, Anabe has you covered. Visit washablesofas.com to upgrade your home. Sofas start at just $699. And right now, get early access to Black Friday savings, up to 60% off store-wide with a 30-day money-back guarantee. Shop now at washablesofas.com. Add a little to your life. Offers are subject to change and certain restrictions may apply.
For more than 40 years, Formula One was home for Claire Williams and her legendary racing family. Claire's father, the late great Frank Williams, founded his eponymous team in 1977, and since then, they've won 16 world championships, unrivaled by all but Ferrari and McLaren. In 2013, Claire took the baton from Frank and ran Williams for 8 seasons, leading them to 15 podiums and 2 third-place finishes in the constructors' standings. Then, at the end of 2020, she sold the team, ending a truly iconic era.
Williams, it's in our DNA. It is us. It was why we existed. You know, when I used to drive to the factory and I used to see the roundabout with our name on it, I felt like I was home. So I miss the essence of Williams.
Here on F1 Beyond the Grid with me, Tom Clarkson, Claire reflects on her incredible journey in Formula One and what life's been like away from the sport. We discuss a wide range of subjects, from the sale of Williams to what it takes to lead a Formula One team, and what Claire does and doesn't miss about the sport. She also tells me why her father was her biggest role model, why he didn't celebrate success, and how she's keeping his legacy alive today. And she shares very interesting insight into why she stopped George Russell from joining Mercedes earlier in his career, and what she makes of the driver he is today.
George really wanted to go to Mercedes and he was clearly upset. As much as I would have loved to have made George's dreams come true, I couldn't. That was one of the hardest parts of being a team principal for me. I've watched, you know, the start of this season. George is on a different level. And this is what I think you see with drivers. They tip into that zone of just absolute superstardom. And George is there now. I mean, I saw a video of George in the gym the other day. I mean, he looks like the Terminator.
Claire, it is lovely to see you again. It's been 7 years since you were last on the show. You're looking very well, if I might say.
7 years. I can't believe it. But I also, you can probably hear it in my voice, I am so excited to be on your show with you, Tom, because, you know, I love you. We had such an amazing relationship and we go back years and years. And I haven't seen you for goodness knows how long. And now you're in my house. It's so cool. I love it.
Well, thank you for being so welcoming. And while listeners of this show haven't heard you for 7 years, Formula One fans have seen and heard you because you've been on Drive to Survive as a talking head. How much have you enjoyed that?
Yeah, poor Formula One fans probably thought they'd gotten rid of me. A lot of them anyway, and then I'm back. It's really sorry about that. I feel really privileged that Drive to Survive, you know, that's an amazing show. And I do genuinely feel very privileged that they have asked me to be one of their, I don't know what you call me, pundit. We can't kind of work out what to call me, pundit, analyst, whatever. And I love doing it. And it's a real honour to do it as well. And it still keeps me a little bit in the sport. And, you know, It's great.
You've been on the receiving end of people's opinions for so much of your life. How easy is it to actually be giving the opinion now?
That's the one of the hardest things I find about this gig. It's like, I never, ever liked it. I hate it when people commented on my role at Williams, how I was running the team and all this kind of stuff. And my stock answer at the time was always, you know, if you don't walk a day in someone's shoes, you don't really have a right to judge them. That's what I was stuck to anyway, because I'm sure people don't agree with me. So now to be asked to judge other people, I do find really uncomfortable. So I'm always very mindful, I think, of what I say, because everybody in the sport, they're only ever trying to do the best that they can with what they've got at the time. And so to sit there in judgment is, you know, it's a hard thing to do.
Is it hard to be objective because you know so many of the people you're talking about?
I don't think I find it hard to be objective. At least I don't. I hope that my commentary doesn't come across like I would. No, I don't think it does. I think the very fact that, you know, I do know these people, because not many of them really are new since I've left. There are a few new team principals and drivers, but I do kind of on the whole know most of them. So I suppose it gives me a bit of an insight in how they do work.
Is it scripted?
It's not scripted. You're absolutely allowed to say what you want to say. I mean, you're in there for hour upon hour as well. But also you want to make sure that you do give the viewer, the audience, you know, useful information. You want to be able to translate stuff, and you want to be able to give that opinion, because I have been in the room before. You know, I've been on the pit wall. I know what these guys and girls are going through, and I've experienced it. So having that kind of insight, I think, is useful.
I always think, where do you pitch the level of knowledge? Because Drive to Survive has brought a lot of new fans in, but you're not a new fan for long, are you?
No, and you can pick, I think people pick up stuff really quickly, don't they? And it's not like watching a race, which I find can be, I imagine, for a lot of people, you know, a bit like, what on earth's going on here? You know, what's this C3 tire compound and all this kind of stuff? Whereas Drive to Survive, it's about the personalities, and it's a bit about the reality of Formula One and life behind the scenes. So there's not a lot of complex, you know, explanation to be able to give for people to be able to understand what's going on.
Do you get nervous?
No.
Before going on screen?
I've never been nervous, like, in front of a camera. Put me in front of my team when I was running Williams and doing town halls. That was the moment when the nerves would come out. But put me in front of a camera, because it's an animate object at the end of the day. And as long as you don't think about who's behind it, you know, it doesn't really matter.
Well, I believe in finding your sweet spot. I think you found it.
Well, I'm better behind the camera than sat on the pit wall. Thanks for that.
In front of the camera. Talking of Drive to Survive and Netflix, there's the F1 Academy Netflix series coming out quite soon. I think it's called F1 The Academy, coming out on the 28th of May. Well, and one of your former drivers, Susie Wolf, has set up F1 Academy. Give us your thoughts on the Academy and what it does.
I have always been one to believe in the fact that we need more role models in the higher echelons of motorsport if we're going to encourage the next generation of girls and women to come into motorsport. So any initiative that does that has, you know, my stamp of approval, not that anyone needs it, but, you know, I think it's a great thing that there are these initiatives. You know, anyone that can come along and go, well, you know, it needs to be equitable, or it's not fair that women are getting this kind of leg up. Well, we haven't had it for so long, if I can risk saying that and annoying people, but women haven't had an equitable playing field for a long time. And, you know, I think they need a bit of a help up. And it showcases talent, which I think is hugely important. But it provides that role model platform so that the younger generation can see that there are girls racing. What I hope that it does, it doesn't just inspire the next female racers, but that it inspires women to come in across all disciplines within motorsport, not just the driving area. I think that's really important.
Well, let's a big shout out to Laura Muller, who is Esteban Ocon's race engineer at Haas this year. First time we've had a full-time female race engineer in Formula One. So it's definitely happening. In terms of role models, though, who were yours growing up?
So my dad was always my biggest role model, I think. I was asked the other day, who's the best person you've ever met in your life? And I really stumbled with this, with my answer. It was like, I've been fortunate enough to have met so many people. Yeah, I couldn't think of anyone. But I only ever came back to my dad in my head when I was trying to formulate my answer. But my dad was an incredible role model to me for so many different reasons. But if you asked me it slightly differently and you said, well, Claire, actually, who would you like? You know, that question, who would you have at your dinner party if you could have six people? The two names at the absolute top of my list were always Margaret Thatcher and Elizabeth I.
Well, so you are so probably, like your dad. Your dad was a massive Maggie Thatcher
fan. He was a massive Maggie Thatcher fan. And so clearly I inherited that from him. But I think that, you know, if you think about it now, how many female PMs have we had in the UK since her time? Only two. And you know, she was PM when she... 50 years ago now, can you imagine a female PM in the 80s in Britain? I mean, it's just extraordinary to even think that back then that was possible. You then look and go, well, how much work has actually been done around the promotion of women in society? Not a huge amount, and probably won't go down that road. But those two women, for me, just were enormously powerful.
Give me a history lesson. Why Elizabeth I?
She operated in a man's world and... oh gosh, there was a very famous, what's the expression where she said, I may not have the something of a man, but I have the heart of a man, or something like that. And I just, you know, she absolutely killed it in a male world for her whole life in that time. I mean, what's not to love?
Claire, tell us more about your dad in terms of the influence he had on you. Why is he the ultimate role model?
I think there's definitely... and any father-daughter pairing will tell you this, there is definitely the father-daughter thing that we had between us. We were always incredibly close. Well, I say that, but actually, when I was born, apparently my father was livid that I was a girl. And when he came to the hospital, because dads weren't at hospitals when, you know, their wives were giving birth back in those days, when he came and turned up after I was born, and my mum was horrified as well that she'd had a girl. And
hang on, you've got an older brother. So
yes.
If they desperately wanted a son, they'd already got that.
They did, but he didn't want, a daughter was no use, effectively. I think that was I don't know what it was. I never dared ask, really. But yeah, my mum was terrified of my dad's arrival into hospital because she had to break the news that she'd had a girl. And when she did, my dad was furious and left. He didn't stay to hang around and see me. And for 6 months, apparently, he completely ignored me. Just my presence was, I had not arrived. I don't know what he was planning on doing with me. He never talked to me for my life. But after 6 months, we just went from strength to strength. He decided maybe I wasn't so bad after all.
But what character traits did he have?
Resilience. He never moaned. I don't think what a lot of people don't realise about my dad was that he was in pain for most of his life due to his injury. And he never once complained about it. He never once complained about his whole injury. The fact that it would take him 3 hours to, get from bed to downstairs in the morning takes, anyone normally 10 minutes up to an hour, right? How long it takes us to get ready in the mornings, 3 hours. Never complained about it. Traveled the world despite the discomfort that brought him. He was just extraordinarily resilient, and he was very modest despite all the success and adulation that he had. He remained humble. There was no ego. You talk to Dad about his success and he would almost be embarrassed by it and go, well, it was not me, it was Patrick, it was the team, it was a brilliant team here at Williams, it was everybody else. The work ethic I admired enormously. I mean, I could be here for the whole podcast, talking about...
I felt it was always about the next race as well for him. Okay, let's not talk about the success in the past. It's all about what we're going to do next.
Do you know, that was one thing I never got, really. Because when I was running the team in the final few years, we actually made a point of celebrating the small successes that we did have. And that's really important to team morale and focus and mentality and performance. If you just win a race and you don't afford people the right amount of opportunity to celebrate that, why are you doing it? And you've got to give people, you know, when you win a Formula One race, that's an extraordinary achievement. People deserve to celebrate that extraordinary success. So I never quite understood that. I got it to the degree that the competition is coming and you've got to keep on your toes and you've got to keep fighting against everybody else. But equally, you've got to afford your team the opportunity to celebrate the win.
I think that's one of the changes we've seen over the last 30 years is that people are celebrating the successes now. You see the teams in the pit lane after the race doing the family photo with the trophy, right? Fernando Alonso has said on this podcast he wishes he'd celebrated his two world championships in 2005, 2006 more. Whereas Brazil 2005, great party, got on the plane home. I was already thinking about 2006. It's like, wow. Fernando, you've just won the world title.
Yeah. And
he regrets it now.
Yeah.
And I think that's why when he got those 8 podiums a couple of years ago with Aston Martin, you saw him really happy on the podium. He was going to embrace every success.
I don't blame him because success is so fleeting, isn't it? I mean, I remember the early days of my time running the team and I got 15 podiums. You know, and that was more than anyone outside of Toto and Christian. And yet we rarely, towards the end, I mean, I can't even believe I say this these days, but towards the end, I'd be like, do I really have to walk down to the podium again? You know, this is really boring. I mean, that's awful. That's awful. If I could, you know, go back to those days of I'd walk a mile on my hands and knees and, you know, rain to get down to the podium again. You should celebrate the success. So yeah, that wasn't something I ever really got with my dad.
There's nothing like sinking into luxury. Anabe sofas combine ultimate comfort and design at an affordable price. Anabe has designed the only fully machine washable sofa from top to bottom. The stain-resistant performance fabric slipcovers and cloud-like frame duvet can go straight into your wash. Perfect for anyone with kids, pets, or anyone who loves an easy-to-clean, spotless sofa. With a modular design and changeable slipcovers, you can customize your sofa to fit any space and style. Whether you need a single chair, love seat, or a luxuriously large sectional, Anabe has you covered. Visit washablesofas.com to upgrade your home. Sofas start at just $699. And right now, get early access to Black Friday savings, up to 60% off store-wide with a 30-day money back guarantee. Shop now at washablesofas.com. Add a little to your life. Offers are subject to change and certain restrictions may apply. Time for a sofa upgrade? Introducing Anabe Sofas, where designer style meets budget-friendly prices. Every Anabe sofa is modular, allowing you to rearrange your space effortlessly. Perfect for both small and large spaces, Anabe is the only machine-washable sofa inside and out. Say goodbye to stains and messes with liquid and stain-resistant fabrics that make cleaning easy. Liquids simply slide right off. Designed for custom comfort, our high-resilience foam lets you choose between a sink-in feel or a supportive memory foam blend. Plus, our pet-friendly, stain-resistant fabrics ensure your sofa stays beautiful for years. Don't compromise quality for price. Visit washablesofas.com to upgrade your living space today. Sofas start at just $699 with no-risk returns and a 30-day money-back guarantee. Get early access to Black Friday now. The biggest sale of the year can save you up to 60% off, plus free shipping and free returns. Shop now at washablesofas.com. Offers are subject to change and certain restrictions may apply.
Claire, the success you talk about is one of the reasons why you are a role model to so many people, even now. But I do want to ask you this. Since you sold Williams in 2020, there hasn't been the mention of another female team principal on the grid. If you were explaining why to a classroom of 16-year-old girls, what would you say? Why do you think there is no female team principal now in Formula One?
I couldn't tell you. It's not a case if there aren't women out there that can run a Formula One team. And geez, if I run a Formula One team, anyone can, quite honestly. I don't get it. When I am asked that question, and I still go out and I talk to, you know, students, and they ask me that. And why? I have no answer. Because I absolutely believe that there are women out there that are perfectly capable. I don't know what it is, but I do think it's a shame because as much as there is all this brilliant work promoting female drivers, I would love to see another female team principal. And I think it's really important. You know, you do turn on the telly and you do still see a sport that is very male dominated because the TPs, the drivers, they are all men. I think it's a societal thing. We're still waiting. There's been a huge amount of work that's been done over the past 10, 15 years in this space. And you are only going to get or see the repercussions, the reward of that hard work in a generation. It's not a work of a moment, this kind of stuff. It takes a long time in order to see change, because you need to get the critical mass at the grassroots level if you're going to get a sea change. And we haven't had that yet. You know, I still don't see many 5 or 6 year old girls, and I've got a 7 year old son, so I know that the girls in his cohort, they aren't asking their parents to go go-karting on a Saturday afternoon, whereas the boys might. What I am seeing though, which is brilliant, is much more teenage girls falling in love with Formula One. And I think so, therefore, whatever that generation is, the 15, 16 year old girls, you might see them stepping up into the more administrative business type roles and therefore taking the TP roles later on.
I was going to say, so it's the administrative side that is interesting, not just the driving side.
Absolutely. And I think that's an area, it's probably an area that's always been considered as it would be more organic rather than something to grow to get a female TP. But it hasn't happened. So does there need to be more of a push, more work to try and build up to that place of getting a female team principal?
I mentioned it earlier, but Laura Muller is now a race engineer in one of the teams. And there are other women in very prominent roles in F1. I think of Emily Prazer, the chief commercial officer. You know, that's a seriously big job. Hey, I think there'll be a woman running Formula One one day. Wouldn't that be an amazing thing?
Wouldn't that be amazing?
But look, from the prism of, you know, okay, me being a man who's worked in Formula One for 30 years, but I see Formula One as a meritocracy and sex, ethnicity, irrelevant.
Yeah.
People just want the best person to do the job. Now, that is my view of it. Is that your experience of it as a woman?
Yes. It's my experience of it as a woman. But I think what we can't forget is the unconscious bias that happens in recruitment. And it was something that we were starting to look at Williams when I was running the team. And it can be, when you talk about this and you go, right, so for example, when we're interviewing candidates for jobs, all of those people that are coming up that we're looking at are male. Why is that? And it turns out, and so much research has been done on this in business and not just motorsport, that we have an unconscious bias for certain roles that we look at men. We don't look at women for whatever reason. And we don't even know that we're doing that. So Williams, one of the areas that we were trying to counteract this was that when we were recruiting, we had to have women in the recruitment pool. So if you were interviewing three men, you had to interview one woman as well, just to make sure that we weren't unconsciously biasing against, if that's even the right expression, in those kinds of roles. That's a really important thing, I think, that we need to make sure that we're looking at, because yes, everybody in Formula One wants to recruit the best people, but equally there can also be an unconscious bias that we're not even aware of, hence the term.
What character traits do you think are best suited to running a Formula One team?
Well, there's a lot, and these aren't in priority order. I think you've definitely got to have thick skin, because the eyes of the world are watching you, none more so now than, you know, and resilience, I think, is a really important quality. You cannot get through Formula One without a massive quantity of resilience within you. A super strong work ethic. You've got to work. This is not, you know, well, we live to, what is it? What is it? We work to live rather than live to work. This is, you live to work. That's what you're in Formula One. It's the lifestyle. It's, you know, it's not a 9 to 5. You've got to be absolutely all in. And to do that, you've got to make sacrifices. So you've got to be prepared to do that. I think you've got to understand the importance and power of team. You know, there's no egos. I think you have to put your ego aside in the sport. You've got to understand that you are one part of a massive machine. Whether you're the team boss or whether you're the cleaner or the driver or whoever, you know, I think everybody plays a part in Formula One in your team in order to be successful. And I think it's understanding that and be prepared to pull your weight and to roll your sleeves up when, you know, shit needs to be done, quite honestly. You know, if the car's just been shunted in P2 and you've got to get it ready for qualifying, then it's all hands on deck. It doesn't matter who you are. If you can lend a hand, you lend a hand to get the car out.
That's all very interesting. And when you look back on the Claire Williams who was running a Formula One team, what do you make of that person now?
I still pinch myself that I ran a Formula One team. It's like, did I really do that? Because it seems like quite a long time ago now. I'm always really surprised when people kind of give me a verdict on who I am, because I don't ever see myself in that way. People see me as quite resilient and all these have these kind of qualities, and I don't really see it. I kind of see kind of a bit of a, oh, I quite like staying at home and being a bit of a mum and, you know, baking and doing my gardening. But then there's this other side to me that can go out and run a Formula One team. And I see myself as, when I was running a Formula One team, I must have been enormously resilient, because some of the stuff that I went through running it, whether that was due to the on-track performance or just some of the other noise that I had to, and negativity that I had to endure. Also the kind of politics as well, and the brain acrobats that you have to do as a team principal. You know, one minute you're in an aero meeting, the next you're in a governance meeting with F1, the next you're talking to the comms manager. You know, all this kind of stuff. You're always one place and flitting around. So I think you have to have the mental capacity to be able to do that. And also I loved the challenge. So as much as the majority of my time was successful, I then flipped to a hugely difficult time, but I never felt overwhelmed by that. And I'm regularly asked that, you know, how did you cope during those times? You know, how did you deal with that stress and the pressure? And I never remember feeling an overwhelming sense of stress or pressure. It was there, but that just fueled me. And it fueled me and powered me to really get my head down and get this done. It was like, you know, this team is not in good shape, and I'm just going to do absolutely everything to make sure that we get to, and whatever that takes, if it kills me, it kills me. But I'm going to get this team back to where we need it to be.
How exhausting is everything you've just described? Because I'm reminded of something Mattia Binotto said to me, which was, it took him 18 months after leaving Ferrari to feel normal again. He said he was that sort of ground down by the whole experience. I mean, loved it, but it's that exhausting.
And how long was Mattia a TP for? Because it was probably 2-3 years, right? I mean, it was Ferrari. It's a different kettle of fish.
How did you find it? When you actually stopped?
Problem is, when I stopped, we were still in COVID as well. So that was weird. I had a lot on my plate because my dad was not well. He was living at the factory. We had to do a big house move for him, his care team. I had to manage all his care team. So I had 2 years afterwards of really all still kind of in on that part of my life. It was probably when my dad died that then I did kind of take my foot off the gas. And it was like, wow, you know, okay, life's really changed and really different now. And I probably can relax a bit. I don't know, it's a different word, but it takes a lot out of you, Formula One, and you don't realize it because you're just fueled on adrenaline. I think throughout your whole time, you don't realize, I think, what the sport, I don't want to use the word takes from you, because it also gives way more than it takes, but it's an exhausting existence. But again, I never felt that. And I think that's one of the most important things that you can do when you work in Formula One, is you've got to look after yourself. You've got to be physically fit. You've got to sleep. You've got to look after yourself. You can't be burning the candle at both ends.
But hang on,
party.
Everything you've just described is incredibly difficult. Burning the candle, yes, that's part of the job. Sleeping, quite difficult with all the hopping around the world and jet lag. It is hard to stay on top of everything you've just described.
It doesn't have to be. The sleep thing doesn't have to be. And that was one of my non-negotiables in Formula One. And the partying. You know, I had a few parties, admittedly, like everyone does. But I've never been to, what's that paddock party thing? What is it? No,
Amber Lounge.
I've worked in Formula One for 20 years. I never once went to Amber Lounge. When all my colleagues were going to Amber Lounge, I never once went. When all my colleagues were going out for dinners in the evening, very rarely, up until the last few years, when I needed to go out for a dinner to unwind, I never went. I went to bed. I went and watched TV in my room by myself, and I went to bed, and I made sure that I had a good night's sleep and I was not hungover the next day, because I can't operate like that. And that was really important to me and my running. Like, we used to run together, didn't we? That was really important to me, because I knew that I had to be physically fit and mentally fit. And that was how I achieved that.
And are you going to tell me jet lag's just a mindset?
Yeah, that for me it was.
You never...
And actually, that's really interesting. Now, I promise you. So this used to really annoy my husband. We'd do the flight to Australia. I'd get to the hotel, order myself an enormous English breakfast, didn't matter what the time was, and then I put myself to bed. And I would have had slept on the plane out for probably 12 hours. And then I would go to bed and sleep the whole night through. And then I would be absolutely happy days. As soon as I got on the plane, I would say in my head what time it was at my destination. And then I would just sleep. It didn't really matter. I didn't care. It was middle of the afternoon.
I think you're just a good sleeper.
I'm a great sleeper. My dad was the same. We'd put our head down and whatever, wherever we were.
I find as I get older, the jet lag gets worse.
It's interesting. Now I've stopped racing and I clearly don't travel as much. My jet lag's horrific. We came back from somewhere in the US the other day and, oh my God, 2 weeks of terrible sleep. And it makes me really cranky, bad sleep. I mean, I've had a terrible sleeping 5-year-old or 7, you know, for a long time. And, or since he was, God, 3 and he's now 7. And, yeah, that puts me in really bad shape.
Well, sleep clearly wasn't an issue for you. But when we talk about what have you missed, what have you not missed about Formula One, what would you say?
That's a good question. I've missed everything about Formula One, pretty much, apart from airport lounges and aeroplanes filled with F1 people. I love all those people, don't get me wrong, and I'm very privileged that I got to go in an airport lounge. However, nothing worse than when you've just spent however long with everybody and you are tired, you've had enough, and particularly if you've had a really crap race weekend, you've then got to get to the airport. And, you know, I would always want to go and make sure I'd showered because you're stinking from the track. And so you got that to compute. When have I got time to have a shower before I, you know, leave the track, get to the airport? Do I have time for a shower? Get to the airport and then you walk in the lounge and it's full with F1 people. So it's like being back in the paddock again when you just want peace. I'm very antisocial as a human and I need my space and privacy and quiet time. And that for me just was like... I literally spent so much time in airport loos because it was the only place where I could get quiet time. It would be like when I used to go to strategy group meetings.
I think you've just given us an exclusive.
I used to spend a lot of time out in the strategy group meetings. I would go and have quiet time in the loos because it was the only place that I would get peace from those 30 blokes. Take my sandwiches, have a snack in the loo.
and do you miss the adrenaline rush of it all? You know, a qualifying session on the pit wall, all that kind of thing.
I think I miss more the people, the team and the camaraderie that brings. I don't know if we recognise it when we're in the sport, how privileged that space is, because the real world isn't like that. And I can attest to that now that I'm out. You are in something when you're in Formula One. You are in a team. You are in a sport. And now, I mean, this sport is just blown up. It's incredible. But it means something. And, you know, a lot of people, you know, would love to be in that position. And so when you find yourself not in that position anymore, it's like, oh, well, this sucks a bit. Got to get used to a whole different world. And it's really difficult. And I always say to people now, appreciate it while you're in it. Get everything out of it that you possibly can, because you never quite know, whatever it is, whether you're in motorsport or whatever, you never quite know when something's going to come to an end and you're not going to be able to be a part of it anymore.
So while recalibrating your life post Formula One, what's been the most difficult thing? Because, I mean, since you were born, Formula One has been your life, hasn't it? And suddenly that umbilical cord is gone. What's been the hardest thing to get your head around?
Not having a team anymore. It's not having Williams. Williams was and is still, it's in our DNA as a family. It is us. You know, we were brought up on it and it wasn't inanimate. It was a tangible, living, breathing thing, I think, for all of us. And I think it bound us together. As a family, it was why we existed. You know, my dad didn't leave his work at home. It was everything. We'd go on, you know, family holiday with my mum, and it was all we ever really talked about. It was at our core. And so for me, that spirit of Williams I miss because it's not mine anymore. You know, when I used to drive to the factory and I used to see the roundabout with our name on it, I felt like I was home as much as if I was just driving to my house, you know, it would be home. I miss, you know, my dad, knowing that my dad was at Grove. I'd miss seeing him. I miss the smells of the factory. I had a painter in my house the other day, and I don't know what it is, but the smell was Williams. It must be some kind of thing in the paint or something. And honestly, it nearly broke my heart, because it was like, that's Williams. And I was like, you've got to come back every day. I need that smell. So I miss the essence of Williams. It's really difficult to explain it. But I think probably the best way, when I went to Miami.
Last year, 24.
Last year, I went to the race. It was my first race back. And I knew it was going to be really difficult. It wasn't quite as bad as I thought it was going to be when I got there. However, when I went into the garage and I saw the cars, I literally physically felt that my heart was going to break in two. Because those cars, they are the spirit of Williams and they're the spirit of my dad. And those cars, and I thought about it a lot, those cars will still have, as much as they're five-year-old cars from our time at Williams, they're so different. They will still have so much of our time at Williams in them. And that was a lot.
Claire, you took your son to Williams, to Grove, quite recently.
I did.
How did that go? How was that the first time you'd been to Grove since the sale?
I've only been back once, and that was for my dad's funeral, because we did this most amazing drive through Williams with dad. And that was the first time I've been back. And it was actually on my dad's birthday, and I wanted to do that to honour my dad. But equally, Nate is 7.5 now, and he's old enough to understand, you know, a lot of that. He gets it a bit, but they've been doing a transport module in school last term, and they went to Brooklands, and Nate came home with a picture of him sat in a McLaren. So it was like, nah, this is not happening. I'm going to have to do something about this. You need to know what your grandpa did. And so I took the opportunity and I asked Williams, and they very kindly said that we could go around and see the museum. So the museum as well is quite a, if anyone's been, it's quite a evocative place. And for me, it's always been very emotional. Even when I was still there, I'd walk in there, I'd like, oh, have a wobble. But it was just wonderful. And he got to see what his grandpa and all those brilliant people that have come before did and what they achieved. And it was a lovely trip, and the brilliant people at Heritage. When Nate was born, we put his name and date of birth on the front wing on Felipe Massa's car. And I was meant to take the front wing, and I never did. But it was a front wing end plate, it wasn't the whole front wing. And but the guys gave Nate a scale model of that very car with his branding on it. And they gave him the wheel nut from Felipe, that exact car of Felipe's. And it's on Nate's bedside table, and he treasures it. And I love that.
And how different did Grove feel today compared to when you were last there in a work capacity? Was the Williams spirit still alive?
I didn't go into the whole factory, so it's really hard to tell. I'm sure it is. The trees have gone, which is really upsetting. I don't know what happened to the trees. I think they apparently got sick, so that's fine. No, the museum was very much as it was. And it just embodies the history. That could never be taken away by new owners. And they are very respectful of that history. And that's a wonderful thing. And that's why we chose these people to buy Williams, and why we sold it to them rather than anyone else. And the people there was, you know, the Heritage team, they're all old mechanics from the race team. And I love that. It's so special. And you can tell how deeply they care for those cars. And they will probably work there forever. And do you know what the other thing? One of the guys that runs it, Jim, he's worked at Williams for more than 30 years now. I remember when he was on the race team when I was a teenager. And he was the one that organised the tour for us. And his daughter is now working at Williams. And I knew his daughter when she was born. And she came to one of our Dare to Be Different events, and that's how she's been inspired. But this is one thing, the wonderful thing about Williams is that you have these next generations that are falling in love with Formula One just like their parents did. And it's wonderful.
Yeah, it makes you feel young, right?
No, I didn't. I did think, don't put a negative spin on it. It's a wonderful thing.
Tired of spills and stains on your sofa? Wash away your worries with Anabay. Anabay is the only machine washable sofa inside and out, where designer quality meets budget-friendly prices. That's right, sofas start at just $699. Enjoy a no-risk experience with pet-friendly, stain-resistant, and changeable slip covers made with performance fabric. Experience cloud-like comfort with high-resilience foam that's hypoallergenic and never needs fluffing. The sturdy steel frame ensures longevity, and the modular pieces can be rearranged anytime. Shop washablesofas.com for early Black Friday savings, up to 60% off site-wide, backed by a 30-day satisfaction guarantee. If you're not absolutely in love, send it back for a full refund. No return shipping or restocking fees. Every penny back. Upgrade now at washablesofas.com. Offers are subject to change and certain restrictions may apply. Life gets messy. Spills, stains, and kid chaos. But with Anabe, cleaning up is easy. Our sofas are fully machine washable, inside and out, so you never have to stress about messes again. Made with liquid and stain-resistant fabrics, that means fewer stains and more peace of mind. Designed for real life, our sofas feature changeable fabric covers, allowing you to refresh your style anytime. Need flexibility? Our modular design lets you rearrange your sofa effortlessly. Perfect for cozy apartments or spacious homes. Plus, they're earth-friendly and built to last. That's why over 200,000 happy customers have made the switch. Get early access to Black Friday pricing right now. Sofas start at just $699. Visit washablesofas.com now and bring home a sofa made for life. That's washablesofas.com. Offers are subject to change and certain restrictions may apply.
There's more to come from Claire in a moment, but I just wanted to let you know about the other official F1 podcasts that you can listen to this week. F1 Nation's review of the Miami Grand Prix is out now on your podcast app. Alex Albon reveals the mental techniques he used to recover from his sprint race penalty to score big points for Williams on Sunday. And this week's F1 Explains is with former Haas team principal Günther Steiner. That's out on Friday.
Can we talk a little bit about the sale? You sold the team in 2020. Have you ever wondered what might have been had you been able to hang on just another year?
Are you kidding? Another That's 80? All I think about. That's why I still dream. I still dream about that. I wish that we had been able to cling on for another year. And I still question, could we have done? You know, and I've had conversations. I mean, Günther Steiner said, Jesus, I can't do his accent. Jesus, why didn't you sort something out? It just carried on for another year. And it was like, it was, if I could have done, I would have done. Of course I would.
I always wondered, Claire, you sold all of it. Was there ever a discussion just to sell 60% of it?
No, there wasn't. And I, from memory, I don't think that that was on the table. It was all or nothing for these buyers, for Doralton. I wish that we had kept 10%. I mean, wow. But, you know, that's not how life works out, is it? And it didn't. That wasn't what happened for us. So I do think, well, you know, I always think, you know, could I have gone and got some private equity and could I have done this? Could I have done that? But it wasn't on the table. You know, Formula One wasn't what it is now. Back then, no one was really interested. I'm surprised we even got the buyers that we did at that time. I couldn't foresee that the sport was going to suddenly explode in popularity and be where it is today. If I had, then I would have borrowed that money and I could have paid it back tenfold and not worried about it. But at the time, you know, with interest rates the way that they were, borrowing any kind of money in a position, you know, that we were in would have been absolutely senseless. It's all so easy to look back on these kinds of scenarios and go ifs, buts and maybes and shoulda, woulda, coulda and all that kind of stuff. But I've learned this recently. I did what I could at the time with everything that I had and with every fibre in my being geared towards doing the best thing for my team and for my people and for my family's legacy. I could not have done more. Maybe people on the outside maybe thought I could, but they didn't have all the information that I had. And I only did the best that I could. And what I will forever be grateful for is the fact that we found great buyers in Doralton, who I think everyone can see now are fully committed to the team. They are fully committed to the sport and they are putting everything in that that team deserves. We managed to find those people. They found us probably more. And we managed to do a deal with them that set Williams's course to a successful path. you know, and that's a massive achievement, particularly in the time of COVID. We didn't make anybody redundant. Everybody's jobs were safe, and that team can now go from strength to strength, I hope. You know, I'm proud of that. I would have liked it not to have been the scenario, but I'm really proud of what we were able to achieve as a board during that, what was a horrific 2020 for everybody.
Mm. Can we talk about some of your drivers now? And I want to start by talking about George Russell, because he lived through those difficult times as a Williams driver. What are your memories of the way he dealt with the whole situation?
When I look back now and I look back on those last two and a half seasons, because it was really back end of 18 and 2019, and then obviously with COVID taking over most of 2020, they were really bad years, really hard, dark days. Yeah, there was glimpses of light. We thought kind of come middle of 2019, things we knew we'd set the team kind of back on a good keel, even keel again. But it must have been so hard for everybody to endure that, because when you're not in a leadership role, you don't, as much as we always try to be really clear and comprehensive in our communications as to what was going on with the drivers, with everybody, when you're not at the helm, you don't necessarily, it's all out of your control, isn't it? I was in control. I knew what was the plan and everything we were doing. And particularly, I think, for the drivers, when they're not in the office day to day, they can't see everything. And you're asking them to do what you're asking them to do. It must have been so hard for George, Nicholas, you know, all those guys that still gave it their all. Particularly for someone like George, when, you know, he wanted to go to Mercedes in that last couple of years, probably. And I couldn't let him go. And I will forever, I hated that. It makes me upset to think about it.
Why didn't you let him go?
Because I needed him. I needed him, I felt, more than Mercedes. And he was in contract. And because if I let him go, what message would that have sent? What would that have done to my team if I'd have let George go? He was one of the greatest things that we had at Williams. And equally, you know, if I'm honest, at the time, when you're doing, and it's not nice ever talking about drivers as a commodity, they are not.
I interrupt you there? Patrick, yeah. Head of all people, yeah. Said they were light bulbs. You take one out.
Yeah, I don't like that. They're, you know, they are people, and George was incredibly important to me. But, you know, when you go into a negotiation with a team like Mercedes and they're not offering you what they should be for your, you know, ace, who is an A-star driver, not just your A-star driver, then why would you just let him go? What kind of team principal would I have been if I'd have just let George go because Mercedes said, we want George now? That's not how it works, is it? A driver's midway through contract and yet another team, you know, the big brother comes along. No, sorry, he's my driver.
What did George say to you about it?
Well, those conversations were obviously private, but George really wanted to go to Mercedes and he was clearly upset. And it was really difficult. It was very hard to stand my ground, because if someone comes to me and they're upset, and it's because of me, because I'm a blocker or whatever I'm doing, it's really hard, you know, but I had to put my team first. You know, it wasn't just about, it couldn't just be about George. As much as I would have loved to have made George's dreams come true, I couldn't at the time. And that was one of the hardest parts of being a team principal for me, and goes against, you know, I'm a people pleaser as a person. That's my personality. I want to make people's, you know, help people and make their lives better and do right by people. And I wasn't able to do that with George. And I will forever not hate myself for that, but it doesn't feel good. But it was, I had to do that for my team.
I mean, he's gone on to win multiple races. He's in a great place.
And I always said to George, sorry to interrupt you will be grateful for this one day because it will build resilience in you. It will build strength and all this kind of stuff. You know, you've got to experience the real shits before you can go and experience and appreciate the greatness that you're going to go on to one day at Mercedes. And we all know you will. And I hope now he has a little bit of that in his head and not just deep resentfulness towards me.
I'm sure he hasn't. And of the drivers that raced for you, Claire Williams, yeah, and Massa and Bottas, etc.
Yeah, yeah.
Was George the fastest, the most complete?
Oh, that's tricky. Because I think he's probably gone on to be and will go on to be. And I hate saying stuff like that because I don't want to ever slight another driver. But I was so lucky that I had Felipe, I had Valtteri, I had all these brilliant drivers, and George. I'd put them in when I had them at Williams, all kind of roughly the same space. But I think George had the greatest level of potential to go on and be, I think, a world champion. And I see it. I've watched, you know, the start of this season. George is on a different level. And this is what I think you see with drivers and what you've seen with Max over the past 2 or 3 years is that they tip into that zone of just absolute superstardom, don't they? And George is there now. I mean, I saw a video of George in the gym the other day. I mean, he looks like the Terminator. Yeah, and that's where you're stepping up a gear as a driver. You know, that's different plane.
That is a great observation, because you think of Max Verstappen, always been brilliantly fast, and that first race win in Spain in 2016. But I think it took him until 2018 to tip into what you've just described, the superstar bit.
I think he's gone into another superstar level.
This year?
Last year. I think they tip over into an almost untouchable zone, almost. And I can't describe it. It's something ethereal. It's, I don't know. And George, I can see him. I don't know whether I just make this stuff up or I just feel it or something. I can see it. I don't know what it is. Yeah.
I mean, I think they all get better. All the really good ones are constantly getting better, aren't they? I think Oscar Piastri's taken a big step, I feel, 24 into 25.
Yeah. And then there are some drivers that are just left lacking in whatever, for whatever reason it is. It's really interesting. And I can't, like, the psychology of it, I find really fascinating. It's what's bred this, what's created this different level ability. Because it's not, you can't almost get a consistency across drivers we've seen in the past to drivers today. What creates this level of just supreme superstardom?
How do you keep getting better? Because you know that they were all trying as hard as they could last year, the year before that, year before that.
Yeah. I mean, Nico Rosberg has really interesting insight on this, doesn't he? Because, I mean, he was up against Lewis fighting for the championship, and he knew he had 1 year to do this. And when you listen to him and what he had to do mentally, and it all, I think for him, it was only about, everything else was on a par, but the mental strength capacity he knew was the thing that would get him over the line against the pace, I think, that Lewis was able to bring at the time versus Nico. And I think that's the differentiator with a lot of these drivers. It's the mental space that they can put themselves in and forsaking everything else that then sets them apart.
Elite sport is marginal gains, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
And somehow I think they are able to compartmentalize what they need to do to get better. And that's the difference between the great and the good.
And the support structure that they have around them, but equally within the team itself. You know, it's exactly the same for a team. You know, it's about the marginal gains, but not even marginal gains, but it's about every area of your team's performance and making sure it is it's absolute optimum, because otherwise you're never going to win. It's like the orchestra. Every single person in the orchestra has to play their note at the right time perfectly. Otherwise the symphony is going to be crap. And it's the same for a race team. The driver has to have that support structure under them as well. Everyone has to be. And you see it, this perfect harmony, when these teams suddenly gallop ahead of everyone else. We've just had it with Red Bull. Prior to that, it was the Mercedes machine. And it's incredible to see. And it should be celebrated. I think, unfortunately, we all get a bit, oh God, if one team's winning. I always say, that's the whole point. This is Formula One. You know, it's about absolute excellence and high performance at its best. It's about the greatness of humans with machines coming together in perfect harmony. We should be celebrating that, not downtreading it.
Completely agree with you on that. And on the topic of Max and the team you have around you, last year was so special from him because there was so much going on at Red Bull off track, yet somehow he was able to keep himself in the right headspace to deliver performances like Imola, and I could go on and on. But the fact that Max was still able, was able to sort of shut out the noise and keep getting better and doing what he's doing.
And that is not easy. You can imagine when you're in that spotlight as well. And that's where I talk about the kind of the supremeness that comes in, that they are just operating on a completely different plane. That's not an easy space. And it's a long season. You're not just having to do it for one event, you know, to win Wimbledon. You know, it's for the whole season.
You mentioned Valtteri. Do you think he deserves another crack at a race seat in Formula One?
100%. I cannot believe that Valtteri Bottas is sat on the sidelines. It doesn't compute in my brain. You know, I think Valtteri, I've got a lot of time for him. I've got soft spot in my heart for Valtteri. I think he is a great driver and he's a great personality in the sport as well. Yeah, I'd love to see him in a race seat. I don't get it, really.
I mean, now we've got the long blonde hair, the mullet. Mm. You always had him with a crew cut.
Yeah, my dad was quite particular about appearance.
What would have happened if Valtteri had turned the 2025 spec Valtteri had turned up in 2013?
So Valtteri, don't be cross, but if Valtteri had turned up at Grove like that, my dad probably would have got up out of his wheelchair and taken him down to the barbers himself. You know, but that is not to say, and I think I probably would have, you know, blinked twice, but I don't think there's anything better than getting a personality in this sport. And particularly, you know, the drivers now, there's a bit less of that kind of tight control, I think. Perhaps I'm wrong. You correct me. I haven't been in the sport for a while. But do you remember when, you know, I was the press officer? It was the BMW days at Williams in the kind of mid-2000s. And everything was so regimented on what, you know, you could and couldn't say, or you could and couldn't allow your drivers to do or say or be. And I think now we're seeing, and drivers, they were, seemed almost, some of them were okay with that, some of them were not, but even the ones that weren't, you know, didn't do a whole lot to step or put their head above the parapet. You look at Juan Pablo Montoya, I mean, one of the best personalities the sport has ever seen. It was quite contained, I think. And you can only imagine if he was allowed to let rip in the sport today, what his personality would be like. And I think, you know, that's Valtteri. That's obviously who he is or who he wants to be. And let's celebrate that.
Which two drivers on the current grid impress you the most? If you were still a team principal, who would drive for you?
Oscar Piastri, I just think at the moment he's entering that zone. And that's really exciting to watch, not least because he's managed by Mark Webber.
Ex-Williams driver.
Ex-Williams driver. And they are almost like peas in a pod, those two. It's like seeing Mark all over again. George, I'm really excited to see where his performance takes him over the next year or so. And if Mercedes can give him the right car to take the fight to the McLarens that seem indomitable at the moment. George and Oscar probably.
That's a formidable team.
Can you imagine?
Yeah.
Wow. And nice guys. And that was one of my big things at Williams. I just wanted drivers that knew how lucky they were to drive in this sport as much as how good they were as well. That was really important to me. And I just think those two guys embody what Formula One drivers should be.
Let's end it just with sort of what's next for you?
So I do a lot. Like at the moment, I'm busy. And I love that because I love working. And I love feel like I'm getting up and I've got a purpose in the morning.
I mean, is it all Formula One related?
Or? No, not at all. So I'm an ambassador for Fortescue Zero, which is formerly Williams Advanced Engineering, which was my business when I was running the team. So Fortescue are a massive iron ore mining company in Australia, one of the third biggest in the world. And their owner, Andrew Forrest, is taking the whole operation real zero by 2030. So he bought Williams Advanced Engineering, now Fortescue Zero, in order to help the business achieve that. So that's an extraordinary thing to be a part of. And this man is paving the way to address climate change in this world. And it's extraordinary to just be a tiny part of that and just to watch him, what he's doing. So an ambassador for them, as you can probably tell. And then I'm ambassador as well for Santander. So as part of their Formula One program, they've brought me in to...
So that takes you back to Williams.
So it takes me back a little bit to Williams, back to Formula One. I've done an event for them already, which was wonderful. And there's some brilliant people there. So I'm really looking forward to getting stuck in, doing a bit more for them. I do a lot of public speaking. So I now go all around the world still and I get to talk about my time in the sport. But most importantly, I get to talk about Williams and my time running the team, but also its legacy and its history. And I get to keep that alive. And for me, that's really important because, you know, my parents did, they built a team out of nothing over 50 years. And that story needs to remain in people's consciousness. And I'm very proud to tell it. What else? And Drive to Survive, which is now we've come full circle because that's what we how we started our conversation.
Well, you sound busy. Any new hobbies? Are you still running?
I'm still running. We used to run together, which I loved. You were, as you say, see Dubs, get on with it. Stop stopping. Don't stop, Williams. He used to shout at me, don't stop. And be like, I'm exhausted. I mean,
and you're running faster without me shouting at you.
I tell you, I'm running so slow. I'm on like 30-minute miles. I think this is what happened. Well, it's not. I say this. This is what happens. You know, I'm nearly 50. This is what happens with a woman in the menopause. And my husband goes, there are plenty of women in the menopause running the marathon, Claire in sub threes or whatever. All right, then. Thanks for that. So still running. And, you know, talking about my husband, I get to be a wife. I get to be a mum, which I love. I have my two little dogs and I do a lot of gardening. I do a lot of cooking and baking.
When any writing?
Writing?
Yeah.
Like a book?
Yeah.
My time in Formula One.
I think you've got a book. And one of the best books I ever read was the book that your mother wrote.
Oh, that's nice of you to say. It was a great book.
A Different Kind of Life. I mean, extraordinary book. One of the best books about Formula One I've ever read, without a doubt.
That's nice. Thank you. It was a great book.
Have you got a book in you?
I do have a book in me, and we'll see whether I do. But I'm getting a bit annoyed seeing everyone else's books in the top 10 lists in the airports and WH Smith's wherever I go and see them. It's like, maybe I should be in there. Get my side of events out rather than necessarily what everyone thought they saw.
Claire, thank you very much for your time. Last question is something I'm asking everyone on the pod this year. The sport is 75 years old.
I know. It's amazing.
Do you have a favourite moment in those 75 years?
A favourite moment from, oh gosh, a favourite moment.
You've told me about a good moment, if you need prompting.
Go on, what have I told you about?
I mean, I agree, it's a broad spectrum. You can talk about anything. It doesn't have to be Williams. If it was a Williams thing, I remember you telling me once that you went to Hungary 1992 when Nigel won the world championship and you were making sandwiches, I think you said, for the race team and stuff like that. Yeah. That must have been incredible to be there when Nigel finally gets the job done. But I've now told you what your favourite moment is. Tell us. You tell us what your favourite moment
is. I'm so lucky because I have a lot because I've been in it and I grew up in it. Yeah, there are a lot of from my dad's time, clearly, like you've just mentioned, going to Silverstone when I was little, that kind of stuff. From my time, my favourite moment would be when we took that third place in the Constructors' Championship in 2014. And that was a long time in the making, a lot of hard work over the year and a half since I'd taken over Williams. We'd been in bad shape and we went into Abu Dhabi fighting with Ferrari and we just voted in the double points thing. And I'd put my hand up going, yeah, that's a good idea. And then got to Abu Dhabi and was like, oh my God, there's like hundreds of points still up for grabs. And we've got the tiniest delta to Ferrari. And I remember even flying in over Abu Dhabi that race weekend and my stomach going, I can't cope with this. I really want that third place. This is like everything. And I was a mess. I was a real state all weekend. And before the race, I'd always go and talk to the guys in the garage and just hang out with them for a bit. And they were like, Jesus, Claire, can you just calm down? This is, you know, what is okay. And someone just said, Claire, they looked at me and he said, Claire, don't worry, we've got this. It was Ben. And it was probably one of my most favourite moments, along with the fact that we did kick Ferrari's ass and we did come third in the championship and we did score more points on that Grand Prix weekend than any team has ever done in the history of Formula One. And I loved that. Felipe, Valtteri both got on the podium. I think it was with Lewis in the Mercedes. And it was just probably one of the highlights of my time. But, you know, there are so many. But I think it tells you I did have success. And what else it tells you is that I loved my team more than words can ever say.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
And Claire really did love her team. Not only on the good days like Abu Dhabi 2014, but always. The good and the bad. And I think it came across in this chat that she still loves Williams today. And in case you're wondering, double points in Abu Dhabi 2014 was exactly that. A one-off double points finale in which Lewis Hamilton got 50 points for victory, Massa 36 points for P2, and Bottas 30 for P3. I thought that was a really fascinating chat with Claire. I learnt a lot about a wide range of topics, and especially about drivers. How they tip into the untouchable zone was an interesting aside from Claire. And it was fascinating to learn why she couldn't let George leave early for Mercedes. Claire, thanks for your time. It was great to catch up, and I hope to see you at a race again soon. And hey, why don't we run the track together? Well, that's almost it from me for this episode. I will, of course, be back next week with another great guest from the world of Formula One. But for now, F1 Beyond the Grid is produced by Formula One and Audioboom Studios. Until next time, keep it flat out.
This is Jonas Knox from Two Pros and a Cup of Joe, and on Fox One Now, you can stream your favorite live sports so you can be there live for the biggest moments. That means NFL Sundays, college football games, NASCAR, MLB postseason, and more. With Fox One, you'll get it all live. Edge of your seat plays, jaw-dropping, high-octane moments, and that feeling like you're right there in the action. Fox One, we live for live streaming now.
Hey, it's me, your heart. Mind if I pick the next song? Listen, even though we're eating better, people who've had one heart attack are at higher risk of another. But Repatha Evolocumab plus a statin lowers LDL-C, our bad cholesterol, and our heart attack risk. So let's talk to our doctor about Repatha.
Do not take Repatha if you're allergic to it. Serious allergic reactions can occur. Get medical help right away if you have trouble breathing or swallowing, swelling of the face, lips, tongue, throat, or arms. Common side effects include runny nose, sore throat, common cold symptoms, flu or flu-like symptoms, back pain, high blood sugar, and redness, pain, or bruising at the injection site. View the important safety information in our banner. Listen to your heart. Ask your doctor about Repatha.
Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2x the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18+ in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8/6/25 and 1/5/26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointstc.